Good evening. Michael only agreed to let me mention material from his vita when I offered to make it sound funny. It's much too long to ever sound funny, but at least I can make it a little briefer, or we won't get to hear Michael himself. Michael Burkle is a professor of Christian spirituality at the Earlham School of Religion, and he's just recovering from 30 years of teaching at Earlham from 1986 to 2016, where his appointment was in the religion department, but he taught all over the place. He had other appointments in Jewish studies, classics, medieval studies, Quaker studies, Latin American studies, peace and global studies, film studies, and Middle Eastern and Islamic studies. He was also director of the Newland Center for Quaker Thought and Practice. At Earlham, he taught, this just says so much about Michael, he had offered courses in Hebrew Scriptures, New Testament, the Gospel of Mark in Greek, ancient Christianity, the medieval allegorical imagination in the monastic West, historical Christianity, Quakerism, Scripture and Liberation in Latin America, intermediate biblical Hebrew, translation of Quaker texts into Spanish, pilgrimage on the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, Abrahamic scriptures, Abrahamic mysticism, Islam and film, that's the film studies part, spiritual but not religious, and religion and Doctor Who. This is the guy. And Michael's most recent publication, still in the works, but watch for it, is Friendship, Time, and the Power of Memory in Augustine's Confessions and in the Revived Doctor Who series. And that's forthcoming in the Journal of Religion and Popular Culture. So, you can see why I'm not going to read the whole vita, but it's wonderful. Fortunate people like me associate meetings with Michael with walking around somewhere, sometimes Earlham, but sometimes other places, and fortuitously running into him. And pretty soon you're walking alongside Michael and find yourself stepping into unexpectedly deep waters. And you might find yourself in 16th century Spain, marveling at some obscure detail of Kabbalistic cosmology, or in Manchester, New York, wondering about the mysterious golden plates of Joseph Smith and the founder of Mormonism, or in Tibet, in Lhasa, watching the early merging of ancient animism with Buddhism. You might think I'm making this up, but only partly. And when you finally come up for air, you wonder, what wonderful gas have I been breathing? And you've been with Michael Burkle. And Michael obviously knows a lot about a lot of things. But unlike many learned people, it's not just a vast pile of content. It's the way he bears this knowledge, that he bears the learning that he has, and the way he shares it. He shares it as an illumination that enriches the life of anybody who joins him in it. Some religious thinkers, a lot of religious thinkers, theologians, seem to regard their work as a form of butterfly collecting. You gather exotic specimens, kill them, put them on a pin, and put them under glass with some elaborate wall text. Michael is more the catch-and-release type. He regards religions as living sources of light for their adherents. And he studies them as a way of visiting that light and bringing other people into it. When he teaches, he's visiting that light with the student or with anyone who will join him on that walk. As if learning were a sort of hospitality rather than a sort of accumulation. Well, we have an opportunity to share in that tonight, as Michael will invite us into that treasury of light. And his theme is very appropriate to him. Hospitality among religious communities. And I don't know anyone more hospitable about religion than Michael Burkle. We'll hear from Michael, and then we'll return into silence for a while after he speaks, and then out of that, we hope some discussion will follow. Michael Merkel.
Can I tell a story about Andy? This is a cosmic apparition. I was, a couple summers back, I was in Berkeley for several weeks at a distinguished gathering sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities to study classic Buddhist texts, which at least which one member in my dear family, whom I will not name, called Michael going to Buddhist camp. So I was at Buddhist summer camp in Berkeley, and I'm trying to find my way to Strawberry Creek Friends meeting because I'm in town. I wanted to go hang out with the Quakers. And I'm wandering through this part of town that I don't really know. And if any of you know anything about my sense of direction, you would be laughing right now. The some of you know me. So so I'm hoping I'm going in the right direction. And suddenly, two people appear. Just, you know, I mean, it's early morning in Berkeley, early Sunday morning. Nobody's out, you know, and these two people appear, and I think, maybe they're divine messengers sent to guide me to Strawberry Creek Friends meeting. And I get closer, and they have this aura about them that I just know they're Quaker. And I get closer, and it turns out to be Andy and his wife Celia, who had come all the way from Indiana to make sure that I got to meeting on time. So, thank you. Shows up in the most interesting. But the other story I want to tell about Andy is, can I tell them the Sesame Street story?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I better ask permission for that one. So, Andy came to a yearly meeting one year, and we don't always just talk about abstruse religious topics most of the time, but sometimes other important things. And he said, you know, I forgot to bring my sheets. Could you tell me, you know, how to get to a store where I could buy some sheets? And I said, we have sheets at my house. You know, come to my house, we'll get you some sheets. So he comes to my house, and I say, well, I can get you white, I can get you striped, or I could get you Sesame Street. He picked Sesame Street. That says a lot about him. I just thought of him, you know, surrounded by light, because here we are at a yearly meeting, and him just kind of nestled in this dormitory bed, you know, snuggling up with Grover and Big Bird. Oh, how embarrassing. So anyway, so thank you for the introduction, and thank you for the invitation to be here. You know, I get invited to do things among friends sometimes, more often really than I deserve, but it's one thing to be invited someplace far away, and it's another thing to be invited by your own community, by people who have known me for many years and love me just the same. And so it's a delight to be here in your presence. Thank you to all the people that made it possible, planning committee, Heather, all the conversations to make it happen. It's an unusual week to be giving a talk to a group of people. If you think of what's happening somewhere else in this country right now, those of you who are secretly following tonight's events of this week's political convention on your cell phone know what I mean. I've got my teleprompter here. It's great to look out at the various delegations. I'm trying to figure out which of you are the superdelegates. For those of you who are hoping to hear Hillary, she's not supposed to come on until 11, and I think we're going to be finished a little before then, right? Okay. So, months ago, when I was asked to be here tonight, Heather mentioned a topic, talk about hospitality among religious communities, what I learned as a guest among North American Muslims. And at the time, I thought that might be appropriate. But in light of the fear-mongering and I'm not a lawyer. Can I use the word hate speech? That's floating around, including among people who are candidating for the highest office in this country. It seems more vital than ever to talk about this. And so the purpose of my talk is not to praise Islam as though it had no problems. It's not to promote conversion to it. my point is simply that by listening to people from a different religious community, I came home not simply with a fuller understanding of their faith and practice, but I was inwardly enriched by the experience of engaging them in dialogue, by witnessing the beauty of their community, their faith, and its ideals of justice. This is not to deny that terrible things are done in the name of that religion or any religion. We all have a lot to answer for. This is not to suggest that the Muslim community doesn't have to a lot to answer for in terms of its own past and present when it comes to justice, just like Christianity. There may be people in this room who have been personally hurt by some Muslims, and I would never want to trivialize that pain. But instead, I want simply to point out some ways in which the Muslim community, and in my experience, is developing on this continent. On the one hand, it's a very difficult time to be a Muslim in this country. I'm going to talk about a project I was engaged in a moment. One of the people I met in that project, an African-American Muslim, said to me, "You know, Michael, I drive black, but I fly Muslim." So it's not an easy moment to be a Muslim in this country. On the other hand, it's a very exciting time to be a Muslim in North America, because here in this land, Muslims from all over the world meet and enrich one another with their spiritual, intellectual, political, and cultural work. So I want to talk about hospitality among religious communities, what I learned as a guest among American Muslims. And I'll begin with a disclaimer. I'm not a trained scholar of Islam. I say that, first of all, because it's true, and second, because I suspect there may be some people in this audience who are. Quakers are like that. You never know. They have more education per square inch. Well, I'll just leave it there. I've read some books on Islam. I've taught myself some Quranic Arabic so I could appreciate the beauty of the Quran and its original language. And it is beautiful, even if it doesn't sound so beautiful when read in my fierce Midwestern accent. But mostly I learned about Islam from meeting faithful Muslims who were willing to share with me about their religious convictions. I'm a teacher by vocation. And for me, teaching is a form of truth-seeking and truth-telling. Teaching is a form of peacemaking. I hope this sounds familiar to my co-Quakers. My understanding of what I do as a teacher is rooted in our testimonies. So there's so much misinformation, so much intentional misrepresentation of Muslims going on right now, I thought, how could I teach an alternative to this at least partially false and certainly incomplete portrayal of the Muslim community? I didn't learn about Islam because I felt particularly attracted to it, in fact. I came to appreciate its beauty, but, you know, I'm a liberal Quaker. If I wanted to choose another religion to study, it would have been something cool like Buddhism, right? That's not to make fun of Buddhists. After all, I met you when I was at Buddhist camp. But I went there out of a sense of leading, I guess I would say. So I went and met with over 20 Muslim leaders and religious scholars, and I asked them if they would talk to me about a passage from the Quran that was particularly meaningful to them. This resulted in a series of wonderful conversations in which I witnessed the beauty and power of the Quran as it comes to life among Muslims in North America. So what I want to talk about are these topics, a little bit about holy texts. I want to talk about themes of beauty and justice. I want to talk about spiritual hospitality. So that's the map of where I want to go here. Sacred texts give life to communities, but only, I think, because they come to life in communities. And all sacred texts have their difficult passages, and that's why they need a community to interpret them. One of my Muslim conversation partners told me, a sacred text is a conversation. So I want to hold that up as something to consider. I want to read a passage from the Quran, one that is widely read and quoted by Muslims. A few weeks ago, our Muslim neighbors were observing their holy season of Ramadan, which they regard as the month in which the Quran began to be revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And this is a passage from the Quran that describes it. For those of you who are keeping score, this is Surah 97. It begins, "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate." This is God speaking. "Indeed, we sent it down on the night of power." And what can tell you? What is the night of power? The night of power is better than 1,000 months. The angels and the spirit descend upon it with the permission of their sustainer on every task. Peace it is until the break of dawn. The earliest portions, or as a Muslim would say, revelations of the Quran, are mostly found at the end of their book. They tend to be short and very poetic and moving. And this surah describes the descent, the coming down, the tanzil of the Quran, the experience, therefore, of becoming a prophet. I find it profoundly numinous with this sense of spiritual presence. The angels are there, the spirit comes down. One night like this is better than an entire lifetime. Although, actually, I have to say, a Muslim pointed out to me, it doesn't say that, Michael. It says it's better than 1,000 months, so that's 83.3 years. So I want to be precise there. It's better than 83.3 years, and it brings peace all through the night, even as it utterly changes the one who receives this message, because it is a commissioning to become a prophet. It is a giving of a message to share with others. So that's one quality of the Quran that I encountered by being in the company of Muslims, this sense of that all the goodness of the universe is at hand, and it is trustworthy. It gives you peace, even as it alters one's life completely. Well, prophets have messages, so I want to draw our attention to a second surah, a second chapter of the Quran, 107. It goes like this. "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, do you see the one who denies religion? The one who pushes the orphan away and does not urge the feeding of the poor. Woe to those who pray but are unmindful of their prayer. Those who make a show but hold back the common kindness." One of my Muslim conversation partners spoke with me with these words. He said, "Have you seen the one who denies religion? If we stop there," he said, "I might ask you what you think it means to deny religion. Many people might guess that for Muslims, this means people who do not observe the ritual obligations, say, to pray 5 times a day, or to fast when required, or people who are somehow not pious. But the answer is the one who casts away the orphan and who does not urge the feeding of the needy." This is a strong indictment of people who have taken rituals stripped of meaning as the goal of the religious life, he said. Rituals are only means, not ends. The goal, he said, is social justice, care for the marginalized, common kindness. These are sacred duties. Prayer, he says, is to remind you of what you need to take from your prayer into the rest of your life as you live it. Otherwise, outward ritual observance is only show. I have a feeling I don't need to tell Quakers this. That's been one of our trademarks from the beginning. But not everyone knows that Muslims also may see this as the heart of their own faith. Many of the people with whom I met focused on social justice. One spoke on human rights in Islam and compared it with civil rights in the U.S. Others spoke of racial justice. I met with several powerful feminists who were voices for gender justice and based their stance on what they find to be the core message of the Quran. And they said it's not easy because there are some Muslims who say, look, if you're a Muslim, you can't be a feminist. And then they also said to me, and there are other people who said to me, look, if you're going to be a feminist, you can't be a Muslim. But they, in fact, draw their understanding of their feminism from this call for justice that they find is the core message of their sacred text. So I talked about beauty and hearing this surah from the descent of the Quran, the coming down, the commissioning of the Prophet Muhammad. I've talked about justice as part, as the core of a message that he was to bring to his community in 7th century. I find these themes of beauty and justice come together in the words from another person with whom I met as I was getting acquainted with Muslims in the North American context. Here are some of the words that Zain Qasim spoke to me as she met with me. She focused on one phrase of the Quran, which is this. Wherever you turn, you shall see the face of God. Quotation from the Quran. Wherever you turn, you shall see the face of God. And she said to me, this essentially means that everything I see around me is also the face of God. And it's not just human beings. The idea then began to extend for me into treating all life forms, whether they're animals or plants or trees, creatures in the ocean, birds in the air, everything that carried life was included in this particular verse. Everything in creation is a revelation, a sign from God. Wherever you look, you see the face of God. To me, she said, this verse in the Quran calls people to a moral accountability for the actions we're undertaking, for what humans have done to the earth and its ecosystems in terms of anthropogenic contributions to climate change. We're not fulfilling our responsibility to creation. She said, I think morality is something that is internal. Whoa, I kind of felt good to this Quaker. Begins within, something inward. She said, morality is something internal. The kind of choices we make, the sensitivity that we develop toward relationality are a question of dignity. First, the dignity of ourselves, then the dignity of all of creation. And then she spoke of prayer, which, as you may know, Muslims do 5 times a day. And she said this about prayer. Prayer, meditation, and reflection have a unique way of opening up inner perceptions that then allow us to be receptive to and cognizant of what we're seeing on the outside. Our eye for beauty is opened through prayer, so that when we chance upon beauty, there's an inner sense that is willing to receive it and the grace that is all around us. Similarly, she said, the ability to see injustice and be sensitive to it is opened up through prayer, meditation, and reflection. Then we want to respond. That's the connection between the inner and the outer, because the face of God that you see everywhere is not just outside, it's also within, she said. She said, prayer, meditation, and reflection are methods to cultivate our sensitivity to beauty so that we can perceive divine presence everywhere, and cultivate our sensitivity to injustice so that we can act for justice. I'm not going to call her a Quaker, but I'm going to say, that sounds like a good description of meeting for worship. And by that, I don't mean to... I don't want to be one of those people that says, oh, you're a Quaker and you don't know it. I actually don't like that. We can talk about that later if you like. I think of it as spiritual identity theft. But the, well, it is, you know, because you're saying the only thing good about your religion is where it overlaps with mine and I'm taking credit for it. that doesn't really, you know, you may mean well when you say that, but it doesn't always feel quite that that way on the receiving end. Anyway, so you have a bit of a sense of what some of the people said to me. Here are a few more things. Now, not all Muslims would agree with what I'm about to report that they said to me. In fact, several of them said to me that diversity of opinion was, at least in historically, regarded as a divine mercy to the community. Diversity of opinion was regarded as a divine mercy. They said, you know, we're getting a little short on that sometimes in the actions of some Muslims, but it's there and it needs to be brought back, they said. So what I'm about to tell you is not what all Muslims would say, but hear what some Muslims said to me. What's the goal of human life? The purpose of human life is to identify, understand, and emulate the divine attributes of God, to know God in order to live a God-like life. I think I've heard words like that, maybe translated into Quakerese. Here's another one that might surprise some of you. We hear that Muslims are obsessed with the afterlife, that extremists are motivated by earning their way into paradise, where they will be rewarded by the companionship of partners for their physical pleasure. However, this Muslim said, heaven and hell are not two places in the afterlife. Heaven and hell are conditions or states that people find themselves in. When one is close to God, not physically but spiritually, that is, when one has developed those divine attributes within oneself, one is in a heaven-like state. When one is detached from God, one is in a state of hell. Hell is not for punishment, it's for reformation. God lifts people up from hell, out of that spiritual condition, when they're ready to progress to the next spiritual stage. Likewise, the joys of paradise are also symbolic. They're metaphorical. There's no gratifying of physical desires. That may not be what you hear from the media on Muslims obsessed with the afterlife. Or justice. This is a quotation from someone who spoke with me. The call of the Quran for justice is a call to resist patriarchy, hegemony, racism, sexism, homophobia, and the unjust class system. The Quran itself, she said, is the basis for this reform, the basis for the transformation of the law and culture of Muslims themselves toward more equality and more reciprocity. Many spoke with me about peace and violence and religiously sanctioned violence, and spoke against what we see, what we hear from extremists. I'm sure that's not a surprise to you. But those are just a few moments from my experience among our Muslim neighbors. We can say more during Q&A if you like. But I'd like now to turn to some reflections on what it meant to me to be a guest in someone else's spiritual house. Well, first of all, in my meetings with these folks, I encountered wonderful hospitality. I came ready to listen deeply, and I thank my Quaker community for teaching me how to do that. I came ready to listen deeply. They came ready to share what is precious to them. Often, these conversations were holy moments. We were on sacred ground. We could both feel that. There was a moment when someone said to me, I can see your nur. And nur is an Arabic word from the Quran, used in the Quran, that means light. I can see the light, the spiritual light within you. Now, of course, I was tempted to say, light? You want to talk about light? We Quakers, we do light. I didn't say that. I received it as a gift, which was what it was intended as a recognition of a spiritual kinship. So, as I said, I encountered great hospitality, and hospitality is an exchange. At times, or I think at its best, hospitality is is when the giving and the receiving travel in both directions. Because our word hospitality comes from an old word, hospes, in Latin, which means host, but also means guest. Hospitality is not about who's giving and who's receiving at any particular moment. Hospitality is about that exchange. It's about that relationship. And I had moments of that. So I had wonderful moments of hospitality. And of course, I never expected to be more than a guest. I was not shopping around for another religion. It's hard enough for me to be a Quaker. maybe it's easy for you. frankly, I don't think I'd make a very good Muslim. So it's a good thing I wasn't interested. But that wasn't the point of our coming together. We respected the boundaries between our communities, and I think the boundaries between religious communities are to be honored because they don't just keep out. They also hold together. And if you think for a moment, if religion were left to majority rule, you know, we'll get rid of all boundaries and we'll just decide what religion ought to be like. if we're left to majority rule, we Quakers would probably have been voted off the island a long time ago. And I personally think that would have been a loss to the human spiritual legacy. So what does it mean to acknowledge the depth and the beauty of someone else's religion? Well, it can change you. I can't predict how it would change you, but perhaps it will widen your world. Perhaps it will make it better and richer. My own time among Muslims has been to me like a present that is slowly unwrapping itself. But I can say that my life has been enriched by perceiving the beauty of their tradition, of their lives, by honoring their by acknowledging their ethical commitments. It's been enriched by friendships. It's been enriched by the experience of mercy and compassion. As some of you know, a book came out of this work that I did, having these conversations. And if you look through it, in every chapter, mercy comes up prominently. We don't always think of it this way. And that might not be the first word that comes to you when you, if your information about Islam is only from our general media, but it's there. And I not only did I encounter it, but it made me realize, you know, it's very strong in my tradition, even though we don't, you know, if you think of what are the top 10, you know, important items for Quakers, is mercy in there? Well, we might not make the top five, but it's in there. And I went home and rekindled that flame, if you will, in my own inward life. They reminded me of something in my own tradition by living true to their own. So what does it mean to acknowledge and appreciate someone else's faith? Here I think of the 4th century non-Christian, we might say pagan, or follower of traditional Roman religion, the 4th century non-Christian Symmachus, who urged toleration for his religious heritage in the face of persecution from the early Christian empire. He made this famous utterance: "Surely, by one path alone, it is not possible to arrive at so great a mystery. Surely, by one path alone, it is not possible to arrive at so great a mystery." And for you nerdy Latin scholars out there, utro itinere non potest pervenire ad tam grande secretum. Is it all the same grand mystery toward which we strike to seek a path? Is it all the same mystery that we're yearning toward? that we're yearning for? The fact that it is a mystery, that is, that's something beyond the powers of human utterance, compels me to admit that, you know, I can't really be sure that I know. I think that's part of what makes something a mystery. So is it the same mystery? Maybe I really can't say that I know that fully. However, the power of mutual recognition, that sense of kinship that I described a moment ago when someone said, I can see your nur, I can see your light, that power of mutual recognition suggests to me that it is the same mystery that beckons all of us. In Islam, there is a sacred saying called a hadith in which the divine voice says this, I was a hidden treasure and desired to be known. Is that deep desire imprinted into the fabric of the universe, that desire to be known? If it is, then our coming to know one another can be a sacred task. It can be a holy opportunity for us. And so here's where you come in. The work that I did, as I said, was not the work of a trained scholar of Islam. You heard it, Andy, you know? I studied dusty old monks from the 4th century and slightly less dusty Quakers from the 17th century. I just went and spoke with some Muslim neighbors. Now, admittedly, a special group of them. I spoke with religious scholars and leaders. But I went and spoke with my neighbors. All of us can do that. I encourage all of us to go and talk with our neighbors, whether they are, especially our neighbors who are from other religious communities. There's a good chance that you will experience the same depth of hospitality. I think there's a good chance that it will change your life for the better. Thank you.
like to open this up to some curiosity and some discussion now. And as usual, we'll have a floating mic in the room. And we'd like to hear lots of voices. So I'll go down and circulate the mic.
Great. You can tell us when we're done.
I'll tell you when you're done.
You want to be the timekeeper.
How will I know when we're done?
Well, Hillary's going to talk at 11, so we should try to be done by then.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Michael. I'm wondering, remember a conversation I had with one group of friends when I was asking why it seemed easier to go down the road and talk to folks in a mosque than to go down, go a block away and talk to another group of friends. And was told it's sometimes easier to communicate and to have a sense of hospitality with people that are guests than people that have the same family name. And I'm wondering if your experiences being a guest with Muslims has helped or influenced ways in talking with friends who have different beliefs.
It's a great question. Is this still working?
Yes.
Okay, that's a great question. Shall I sit down or stand? What am I supposed to do here? Whatever I want, okay. you see, one important matter, actually, in interfaith relations is knowing when to sit and when to stand. I once gave a talk about interfaith relationships, and I called it hats and shoes, because it's all about knowing, you know, where do you put your hat on, when do you take it off, when do you wear shoes, when do you not? I mean, these little gestures of respect. So I'll sit, and if that offends you, I'll stand. But I think that's a great question. I think those are two different kinds of conversations, and both of them are really very valuable. One is people who are from a different religious community entirely, and then there are those people who are sort of like you, but you can't stand them because you disagree on some important stuff, but you maybe share the same family name, like Quaker. And those both of those have to be pursued. My I hope that the motion to do this came from a leading and not from, you know, just being I won't even say this diplomatically, a white person who likes to go out and do exotic things, you know. I don't think that was my motivation. I trust it wasn't. I tried to be careful, self-observant about that. But my concern, as I said at the beginning, was that they are there's a lot of less than truth being told about that community, and how do we address that? That's one kind of conversation. But yeah, I think in a way, coming to a place where you can listen. Without listen appreciatively, and listen without planning your rebuttal while the other person's still talking. That kind of listening that we practice ideally in meeting for worship or meeting for worship with attention to business. I think that's a comparable skill set there. It sounds like you may have some thoughts on your own about this. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know you do both these things. Well, I'm happy for this to be a conversation, not just a Q&A. So, but yeah. Does that answer in any way? I think they're alike. I think they're different. I think doing one can prepare you for the other. Yeah. And that's certainly something you've done in your life. Yeah. And I want to celebrate that.
I was so pleased to hear that you found Muslim feminists.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear a little bit about how easy or hard it was to find them. I think I heard you say you spoke to 20 people, so how mm-hmm. many were women and how many were feminists? Are there any Muslim scholars who are women but aren't feminists? So a lot of related questions there.
Wow, okay. I'll begin by stepping back and criticizing myself as a white person again, if that's okay. I know one thing, my upbringing can tempt me to want to do is to be one of those white people that has a collection. You know, I think I'll have one black friend and maybe one Nicaraguan, and somebody from New Zealand would be cool, you know, if they're native. And I was trying to be aware of that own impulse that some people have. And so I tried to invite people to come and talk to me who were in different places within the community that is Islam in North America, where no one was meant intentionally as a representative to be anyone other than that, you know, a voice for anyone other than herself or himself. And I was pleased that of the 25 people who made it into the book, let's just say, who stayed with me for the whole length of it, 11 were women. Which is a little less than half, but it's not bad for a denomination that doesn't ordain women. Oh, wait a minute, that's Christian denominations, isn't it? So I'm not trying to do equal opportunity insulting here. I'm just saying that, yes, certainly, traditionally, men are in a position of leadership in Islam, as they have been in, dominant in all senses of the word in our own Christian tradition as well. But yeah, how did I find them? I did a lot of reading, and then once I was, I think the community of Muslim scholars is probably kind of like Quakers in that it's a small group and they all tend to know each other, and when someone from the outside comes and starts talking to people, they were talking about me. That was fine. You know, in fact, I remember when one Muslim feminist agreed to meet with me, she said, "Oh, I've been looking forward to this. You know, so and so said it would be I'd have a great time. She said you were a great listener. She thought it probably had something to do with that Quaker thing," which made me feel okay for all of us. But yes, I met with people who would be described as certainly progressive, but I didn't want it to be, you know. Something that's very easy to do in interfaith dialogue is the liberals talk to the liberals, and because they, they have a lot in common. So I didn't want to just be one other, someone from a progressive denomination talking just to progressive Muslims. There are some voices that are in the project that would be described as very traditional. Some topics. Well, I let them set the agenda. So I didn't say, and by the way, how do you feel about topic A, B, and C? So I would only be guessing to know that, I'm pretty sure some would not identify as feminist. But many of the male speakers as well pointed out to me the importance of equality, gender equality within Islam. Now they would understand that in different ways, but it was very important to them. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, it does. And what I heard with 11 out of 25 is mm-hmm. that you were able to find enough women who were Muslim scholars, mm-hmm. so that it wasn't as if I got my token two women, right?
Oh,
yeah,
right.
That's, yes. So that's mm-hmm. the language that I received that information in. And as I'm listening to you, I'm reflecting about the Muslim women I know. I'm from the Cincinnati area, mm-hmm. and there, Shakila Ahmad is a pillar in the community, and often the public face of the mosque in Westchester, which is north of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And Karen Dabdoud is the director of CARE, the mm-hmm. Committee on American-Islam Relations in Cincinnati. So those are the two sort of powerhouse women mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. And as a woman, I actually have met very few Muslim men in for anything other than people getting together for interfaith discussion. So mm-hmm. no relationships. The relationships I have are with Muslim women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who are not, and they're not at all scholars. They're young women who are here because their husbands are studying. But I get to see their lives in a way that definitely affirms that Muslims see themselves and their faith as part of the view that there is gender equality. They just define it in ways that we don't necessarily see it.
Yes, and I found that as it challenged me in an important place to say, okay, I can't tell a feminist how to be a feminist. I have been richly blessed to be in the company of wonderful feminists in my work. For the last 30 some years, but I'm not going to tell a Christian feminist how to be a feminist, and I'm not going to tell a Muslim feminist how to be either a Muslim or how to be a feminist. I mean, it has to be. I have to hear how she defines it for herself, and that was and that challenged me to with my own kind of categories of how justice works or how I think society works. It invited me to see, oh, gee, I really do, for all my efforts, I really do see the world as kind of, a somewhat overeducated white guy, and so that kept coming back to me as something that I have to live with about myself and learn from and try not to let it prevail in how I perceive the world.
Thank you.
Great question, thank you.
All right, so you've done a great job so far. I just want to tell you first off, but
thank you.
So what I wonder is this. So in the aftermath, so like for American progressive liberals to major tenets have been fighting homophobia and fighting Islamophobia. And I think after the tragedy in Orlando, a lot of American liberal progressives mm-hmm. were sort of thrown into a conflict, and they were left thinking like, can I really support Islam and gay rights? And I think mm-hmm. it was a mental conflict for some of them. So my question to you is, have you spoken about LGBT issues or with Muslims who mm-hmm. supported LGBT rights? And how do they juggle the pro-social justice and pro-equality teachings of the Quran with the calls for the execution of mm-hmm. LGBT people in it? And like, and how do they support LGBT rights within the Islamic world?
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Great question. just a couple things as a kind of preface to my response. One is, before I had my first interview conversation with this group of Muslim religious leaders and scholars, I had the good sense to say, I don't want to ask them any questions. I don't want to impose anything Any questions on them? That's just the way that I chose to do this work. That is to say, if something is important, it will come up within the community. You know, of course, I wanted to know, what do you think about women and their rights and their role in society? Of course, I wanted to know, how do they, as Muslims, feel about people of other religions? Because that's a very conflicted issue in our time. And of course, I wanted to know, what do they think about violence and nonviolence and the role of religion in sanctioning it or prohibiting it? But I didn't ask that, because then that would be my question. When I went to them, I said, choose something from your sacred text that is meaningful to you and talk to me about it. And what's interesting is how those issues came up again and again. But they came up because they were important within the community and not because this outsider is imposing, you know, my agenda on it. Does that make sense? So I didn't bring up that issue, and I didn't bring up any issues. The issue of issues of LGBT rights came up really only a couple of times, and by people who were advocates for justice, right? I would say this: just as some Muslim feminists feel attacked by other Muslims and other feminists for trying to do both, I know that some LGBT people within the Muslim community feel under attack from, well, if you're really going to be out, how can you possibly stay with that fiercely oppressive religion, as opposed to what other religion? I mean, you know, a lot of religions have a lot of, well, anyway, that was a gross historical generalization there that I can back up if we like one-on-one later. But the I would say I did not, that did not emerge as a central issue in this work. But I would say my own explorations have led me to discover that there are important and rising groups. Of course, it's very complicated within that community, but there are important groups that support and nourish one another and find a way to strengthen one another in as members of the wider LGBTQ community and as Muslims. It just happens. There are meetings that I, as you know, a boring white straight guy, are not invited to, and that's fine. It's not my business to be there, you know. because what good would it be to have me there? But I know that those things happen because I know people who have been around those events. Andy mentioned I taught a course on Islam and film. This takes us beyond the bounds of the United States. My work that I was describing here was trying to understand Muslims within the United States, because on the media mostly we hear about extremists who are far away, and I wanted to know who are the, if there's such a thing as a mainstream, who are the mainstream Muslims who are here in the United States or North America, and so that was a particular focus. But if you want to see a film that drives some of my students crazy and in all the right ways, there's a film called Jihad for Love. Jihad, not in the sense of holy war, but in the sense of struggle, which is what jihad means. We can talk about that some more if you like. And it's it took a number of years to make by a gay Pakistani filmmaker who traveled, I think, in about 9 countries, interviewing gay and lesbian and transgendered Muslims. And where it drives my students crazy is they want to say, well, why don't they just leave Islam? And if you listen to the people in the film, they say, this is how I encounter God. This is what gives me everything that is good in life. Don't tell me to leave this. Yes, I'm having a struggle, a jihad, a struggle, an exertion about love, about how my loves come to be and come to be expressed. But don't tell me how to be a Muslim, and don't tell me to leave, because this is a central part. This is as central as my LGBT identity, they say in the film. So you might want to look at that, Jihad for Love. Does that answer your question at all? It doesn't really, but it may give you some more to talk about, or some more to think about. If you want to know about Muslims who are writing within the United States, for example, about gay issues, I'd direct you to the work of Scott Kugel, K-U-G-L-E, Euro-American convert to Islam, was out as a gay man when he converted to Islam. He knew what he was up for, and he's written some. He's written a huge volume called Homosexuality in Islam that you might want to look at. I like a college professor. What do? You know, people ask a question, and I give them reading homework. I'm making fun of me, not you, please. Yeah. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, that gives me some like really good resources to look into, because I just feel like this isn't something that's talked about very much at all.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think that people, whether they're people within like the American media, whether they're people within the Islamic community, or whether they're presidential candidates, like want to present one single narrative and stick to that as though like that's the only reality.
And clearly it's a struggle within the community.
Yeah.
You know, we have to acknowledge that. As it would have been in Quakerism 50 years ago, and still is in many parts of Quakerism, in many parts, many other places. You know, I mean, we don't have a lot of ground to stand on as a group to criticize, at least in the longer sweep of history. I still identify, at least my being a Quaker, as part of the wider Christian tradition. The wider Christian tradition, you know, it's a struggle there too. You know, and I acknowledge that, it's a conversation that I'm very curious about, but I don't need to be in the room when it happens, because it's someone else's work to do. I would just be another intrusive white person, you know, and you know, I've got a bad enough record on that already, having lived long enough in this country.
Hi, thank you, Michael. I'm looking forward to your workshop tomorrow as well. You referred several times to prayer, meditation, and reflection. Now, in 12-step rooms, we refer to prayer, meditation, and self-examination.
Oh, wow.
I'm wondering if that's the same sense as reflection, or how reflection is defined differently.
That was a direct quotation from Zain Qasim. I think, I'm not sure, because I didn't press her on that point, but I think there's some Sufi in her. the mystical dimension of Islam. And I think for her it meant what can happen in that sense of communion with the divine during the formal prayer, as well as in other religious practices, some of them being structured Sufi meditative practices, but also, you know, she's a scholar. She engages in ethical reflection all the time. So I think maybe that's unpacking that a little bit. Does that help?
That helps. I'm also aware, too, that the meaning of the word meditation has changed significantly from the early 1900s to 1960s, kind of when the meaning started changing. But
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would say from the 5th century on, really. Yeah. But that's another conversation, probably.
Michael, thank you. I would love to hear a bit of, if you would be willing to share some of what prepared you as an instrument to do this work, because your approach to it, what you've shared about your approach in acknowledging, what does it mean to acknowledge and appreciate someone else's faith, and approach it in a way that is not about putting you on them. That says to me that there was preparation before you even entered the project. I'd love to hear about that.
Thank you. Very kind question. I want to say this was hard work for me. What I'm doing now, this is learned behavior. I have been a teacher for a long time. I have my teacher's voice. I have my teacher's posture. I can manage with a group of people. But true confession time, I am a shy person. I really am. I'm a shy person. I'm certified shy. I keep up my shyness with annual certification units. But I really am a shy person. I love studying religion. Most of the time, I study dead people because they're just sitting there. I don't have to bother them. I don't have to make an appointment with them. I don't have to explain my work with them. They're just, you know, they're just there. So this was psychically challenging for me to talk to living people that I didn't know. I mean, a couple of these people I had met because I had the privilege of representing Quakers on the Interfaith Relations Commission of the National Council of Churches for several years. And so, you know, that was my connection to some of this beginning. But these people, I didn't know. I had to practice my elevator speech that said, you know, look, you don't know me. And yeah, frankly, I'm not a scholar of Islam, but I'd like to talk to you. And I invited 50 people, and I got about half of that, which was wonderful. Because of these 50 people, you know, they didn't know who I was. They didn't know if I had a secret agenda. They didn't know if I was working for some other cause. And and they're busy. Most Muslim scholars have two jobs. They have a day job, and then they get bothered by people like me all the time. And they don't have time to answer all of them. And they say, okay, this week I can talk to one person. Is it going to be from this guy I've never heard of from Indiana? Or am I going to talk to CNN, where I might have a little more impact on society? So that, you know, all those dynamics were happening. You know, so I just want to say doing this was a challenge for me to try to learn how to be, how to develop Quaker chutzpah, you know. That's one of our testimonies, isn't it? But the inner work, I would say two things that prepared me. One was our spiritual practices as friends. When we listen in meeting, when we come to that quiet place where we can listen without judgment to what is being offered. You know, sometimes, I know at least for one person in the room, it can be hard to listen to some things that are being said. It probably hasn't happened in your meeting, but and you never are tempted to think, oh no, here comes so-and-so again. But I'm tempted to think that sometimes. So I have to get to a place of real hospitality and openness and receptivity, non-judgmental place. So I would say meeting for worship prepared me for that. Sitting on my meditation bench, I know that doesn't sound too Quaker, but I practice a very Quaker way of meditation when I do it. And I can prove that later if you like. But that prepared me for this. I would say one other thing that helped me, not consciously at the start, but then I began to realize, I also have training as a spiritual director, which is a practice of spiritual listening. You listen to someone as she or he blesses you with what's happening in that person's life. And when you, for me, spiritual direction is, it's an act of love. It's an act of receptivity, non-judgmental, being in a non-judgmental place, and it's an act of love. And if I can get to that place, then I can go and listen to people, and as I said, it's listening without preparing a rebuttal. Oh, well, you do this. Well, yeah, we Quakers, we do this, and it's better than yours. No, it was, wow. Something beautiful happens when you pray. Please tell me about it. And not really to ask it that way. That's kind of personal. Maybe to show my interest in them. So these were, does that help at all in answering or at least reflecting on your question? I as I said at one point during the talk, I couldn't have done this without you. You are the people. You're my community. You taught me how to worship, and I'm grateful for that.
Michael, as you may know, I'm from Kentucky, the home of Answers in Genesis and the Ark Encounter.
I'm from Kentucky, too. Did you know that about me?
I did not.
I was born in Louisville, and my family crossed the Great Divide into Ohio when I was 6 years old. So I talk like a Yankee, but yeah, I'm from Kentucky.
So this question is about modernity in Christianity and modernity in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And it is educated by an article I've been reading for a mere 5 months. It appeared in the April Atlantic magazine. It was an interview by Jeffrey Goldberg with the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I came away after the article, even though really concerned about his use of drones, really admiring his foreign policy. But there was a quote, and I wondered if I could find it online, and I did. And so I'll read it to you. And I'm curious about your comments about modernity in Christianity and modernity in Islam. And here's the quote from, he's paraphrasing the President of the United States. In private encounters with other world leaders, Obama has argued that there will be no comprehensive solution to Islamist terrorism until Islam reconciles itself to modernity and undergoes some of the reforms that have changed Christianity outside of Kentucky. But
I take that last bit personally. Wow, where do you begin on that? I would say, we can talk about what is modernity, and never get anywhere. But I'm guessing you mean, you know, Europe and North America since the French Revolution or something like that. Okay, or since the Isaac Newton or whatever. I would say various things here. One is that. The Muslim majority countries have not produced very many Nobel Prize-winning scientists in recent decades, but back when my ancestors were barely out of the Stone Age, the 10th, 11th, 12th century, the Golden Age, we call it the Dark Ages in Europe, you know, it was the Golden Age in Baghdad and in Isfahan and other places. there was a history of scientific inquiry and discovery that Muslims are proud of. They would not have a creation museum, not even traditional, very conservative Muslims would not have a creation museum. I mean, it's just not the way they do that, okay? Well, I don't think it's sponsored by the Muslim community in Kentucky. So, in other words, there's at least an inclination toward an embrace of science in many ways. Okay, but I would say this as well: the embrace of modernity is complicated by how these enlightened white people have behaved. Okay, which is to go and colonize these Muslim majority countries, and then when they're done with that, install dictators there or support dictators for a long time. Why is the Muslim Brotherhood so popular among people who have had limited access to education in Egypt? Okay, well, what have they seen? They have seen the Western world. They don't want it in some ways. Because they've seen how it has been lived out in oppressive regimes in their countries that have been supported by the West during the whole period of the Cold War. So here are people who are imprisoned in their poverty and their lack of opportunities to change their socioeconomic condition in life. They're not interested in, well, during the Cold War, they're not interested in what the communist model has for them. So are they interested in the capitalist model? Well, that doesn't seem to be really making their life any better either. But they realize, and they've been told, they go back and read their sacred text, and it says, you're supposed to take care of the poor. That sounds pretty attractive to them. They read their text, and it talks about justice. And they say, wow, this sounds a heck of a lot better than what I'm encountering on the streets of Cairo or the villages to the south, okay? And so part of the attraction to a certain very conservative kind of Islam is that it honors human dignity as they see it, and it speaks of justice and care for the poor. That sounds very attractive to them. Now, I think they're, in some ways, they are, if I can make a political judgment, I'm also not trained as a political scientist, but if I can make a political judgment, I think in some ways these groups are being as manipulated as are some conservative Christians by other political groups in this country. And someday they're going to wake up and realize, wow, I've really been had since about 1980, haven't I? And so, or earlier in some cases. So I think if by modernity you mean Western-style democracy, they're saying, you know, you folks say you have Western-style democracy and we elect somebody we want, and then, you know, you support a military takeover. That doesn't sound so attractive, really. Do you see the complications around that? So I think what we hear of as modernity is democracy, human rights, and so forth, I think is a little more complicated for them.
What if modernity means the scientific point of view? Because I think he's comparing the way Christianity dealt with science and was able to accept, or at least some, Darwin.
Yes. Well, no. And if you mean the scientific method of inquiry, I'd say there's mixed reception in the Muslim community as there is in the Christian community. Well, I think that'd be maybe that's your speaker for next year. I guess both are at work. But I'm trying to imagine sympathetically how it feels if I'm from a poor village in Egypt. I haven't been to a poor village in Egypt, so this is a stretch of imagination. And here's what I would say: you want me to be like what? You want me to take on all these practices that I think are terrible? You say we oppress women. I'm quoting them. I'm not endorsing them. Look at the preponderance of pornography in the West. Isn't that also a form of oppression of women? You're telling me this is liberation. I'm not endorsing their point of view. I'm just repeating it. It's complicated. So I don't want to colonize them with my politics, just as I don't want to colonize them with my religion. If there is an impulse toward freedom and justice within their community, I want to trust them to figure out how to make that happen and not say, you have to be on my team and you have to do it my way. And that means embracing, or at least coexisting with forms that are going to be different from what might be my first choice. People in the room can disagree with me on that. I'm prepared for that. But for me, I think imposed freedom is not really freedom. Imposed justice, there may be other ways to have that happen.
Can you take a couple more?
Sure. It's almost 11, so we should...
Almost 11. Get him a new watch, Quinn.
Were the scholars that you spoke with either Sunni or Shia? I assume they were one or the other of these two major branches. And would scholars of these two branches interpret text differently?
Aha. Uh-huh. Wow, I made a tally once. I didn't ask them if they were Shia or Sunni, okay? I figured if it was important to them, they would tell me. Sometimes I could tell, okay? Sometimes I could guess by what some of their scholarly work has been. If it's been about largely about the Shiite community, oh, well, they seem quite interested in this, don't they? Some I could tell by, you know, when I met the person who was at that point the imam of the largest mosque in North America, and he wore the black turban of a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad himself, by 39 generations. My assumption was that he was Shiite, and in fact, that's true. So I wasn't aiming for 50-50, but there is Shiite representation there. Maybe at least a fourth, which is not bad because you know it's less than that in the just also as I felt blessed that a number of African American Muslims agreed to speak with me because they're often ignored or absent in conversations about Islam in North America, even though they represent maybe 25% is what some people estimate, that much of the North American Muslim community. And I don't remember how many I had, 5 or 6 maybe African American. I was just lucky. I was blessed that they made time in their lives to talk with me. As far as how they interpreted the Quran, I didn't see Shiite versus Sunni patterns. For example, talking about the importance of the family of Muhammad, things that would be typical distinctions. But I would say I found progressive Shiites and very traditional Shiites, and the same thing for Sunnis. That's kind of a bland answer, but they're in there. So does that answer your question at all? Yeah.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Well, it's very interesting to me that this work was done with specifically with North American Muslims. Mm-hmm. And of course, a difference between being a Muslim in North America as opposed to many other countries is that you're a minority. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You spoke about the sense of spiritual hospitality you mm-hmm. experienced in these conversations. And I was wondering to what extent the folks you talked with at all spoke about their experience or lack of experience of spiritual hospitality living in a country where they are a part of a religious minority. Mm. And if that impacted their understanding or their experience of Islam in some particular way.
Great. You didn't ask it this way, but just to clarify, I would say most of the people I spoke with were at least one generation removed from the immigration experience. So most of the people I spoke with had grown up in this country, or several of them in Canada, or maybe came as very small minors. So their cultural experience was their cultural shaping was very, very much within this landscape, this geography. I would say some of them spoke with me about how appreciative they were that I was doing what I was doing. that when people come and talk to them, often it's, well, many of them were engaged in interfaith dialogue regularly anyway, and so they were in positive relationships with non-Muslims. But, you know, a number of them could tell terrible stories about how they were treated by others. Or, you know, I told you the story of Su'ad al-Khabir, who said, you know, she said, I drive black, but I fly Muslim. You know, go to the airport and look for, she, of the female Muslims with whom I met, I haven't tallied, but some wore the veil and some did not. Some wore hijab and many did not. This was a woman who covered, as they would say, a woman who wore the hijab. Have you ever seen anybody like that go through airport security? I'm sure it's just random that they get chosen for extra. or a man, a male who might look like he's Middle Eastern or South Asian, especially if he has a beard, go through airport security. I've witnessed this. I'm sure it's just random that they get hauled off to the little room on the side for extra conversation. So these are people who had those kinds of experiences. I would say this one thing that for them that's very enriching about their being in the North American context right now. Most of the world still does not travel very far. And Islam has been around long enough. It has developed local expressions, philosophically, theologically, in terms of spiritual practices, and so forth. So that there are distinctively Moroccan ways of being a Muslim that are different from Indonesian ways of being Muslim. You know, I mean, they would agree on a lot of the basics, but they're just different cultural inheritances that each of them is enriched by. And most of Muslim history, people like that would never meet each other except maybe if they're doing the pilgrimage, the Hajj to Mecca together. But now, in North America, they meet one another. They might be worshiping at the same mosque. The situation in North America is in a very interesting moment of transition, I think. I'll make a comparison. 120 years ago, okay? Let's say you come to town, you're visiting me, and you're a Catholic, and you say, it's the weekend, and I want to go to Mass. Where shall I go? I would say, well, do you want the German congregation or the Irish congregation or the Italian congregation? Because the immigrant experience was so recent, and so their religious experience was so shaped by their culture back home that these religious communities, these different parishes, were places of ethnic identity. Okay, now for most places in the United States now, you go go to a Catholic church, you can't tell if it's Irish or German or Italian or Polish or, you know, so on down the list, because distinctly American ways of being Catholic have emerged. I think we're at a point right now where that is beginning to happen among North American Muslims. So that still, for many, you would say, all right, you're visiting me in Chicago, do you want to go to a mosque? What do you want, Bosnian? Do you want Turkish? Do you want Palestinian? Do you want Urdu speaking? That's still the case, but there's the next generation that is thinking more in English. They still speak to their grandparents in those languages, but their first language is more English. And so it's a very exciting time to watch the North American Muslim community as distinctly North American ways of being Muslim are evolving right in front of us, as people may learn from their Urdu-speaking grandparents, but also, you know, in the mosque, they're hanging out with these folks whose grandparents speak Indonesian or Turkish or Arabic. And their distinct expressions are coming together. So I think, a very exciting time culturally that way. That's a bit of a digression from your answer, from your question, rather. You were asking about hospitality. Have they received hospitality from non-Muslims? Sometimes, yes. Since 2001, it's been kind of complicated. It's been very hard for many of them. So I don't know if that answers your question at all, but there's a long ramble.
Also, to what extent the lack of hospitality may have contributed to new understandings of their spiritual lives. I mean, it's in persecution persecution can be a crucible for certain kinds of religious expression and,
Wow. I'd have to think about that. I don't have an easy answer to that. I will say this, that there was a time in the very early community in Mecca before the migration of most of the Muslims to the city that came to be known as Medina, where Muhammad was the statesperson for that community, rather than being a persecuted minority as they were in Mecca. And some Muslims will say among themselves, you know, being here and being Muslim sometimes feels like like being in Mecca under those early years of persecution. But other Muslims will say, no, it's more like when the Abyssinians, this African empire, this African geopolitical unit, welcomed a Christian, run by Christians, you know, the region of what is now Ethiopia, welcomed these early persecuted Muslims and let them be Muslim, all right? Didn't try to make them Christian. And stay with us while you're persecuted back home. So that's what it's like to be here. Because back home, we were persecuted too. You know, you get together with a group of sincere Muslims, they start talking, and they can be from any of a number of countries. And you let them talk long enough, they'll talk about friends of theirs who are in prison back home. Because of the political situations there. And so they're saying this is not like that. This is more, there's a deep strain in the community, a deep segment of the community that says, no, this is like Abyssinia. We are welcomed here. In some ways, your country professes to Muslim ideals more than what we experienced back home. So back home, we had lots of Muslims, but no Islam. In America, you have Islam, but you hardly have any Muslims. And by what they meant by that is you have a country that strives toward, that aspires to justice and equality and recognition of the dignity of all. Where's my keeper, my carer?
One more,
okay.
Well, my name is Lydia, and I guess I will be your 12th Muslim speaker you've met. Some for you, the first. It was kind of hard for me to say something because, you know, there is a lot of misconception around Islam, and you, when I'm very untraditional. As you see, I don't wear my hijab. I don't dress in purdah. So I identify myself as an American, and that's kind of how I tried to look at it. I've gone out with my mother. She, her and my father, they basically converted to Islam. So they grew up with Christianity, both sides, and they found discrepancies, I guess, in a sense, which I've kind of found myself in certain, you know, aspects of it. I do think that, you know, there are beautiful aspects of most religions, and that tolerance that you speak, it kind of, you know, just struck a chord with me. And I just wanted to say that I do appreciate everything, you know, even with the questions and the answers, certain aspects that, you know, people have asked, I for the most part agree with everything you answered. And, you know, I, again, very nervous kind of speaking out, but I do appreciate your teachings. And I think ignorance is a big part of misconception. you spoke of the jihad and love towards it. I have always been taught love for all, hate for none. That's kind of the base principle I've always, you know, distinguished from basically learning at the mosque or from my parents. And so the tolerance that I see kind of, you know, with Quakers or and things that I've studied, it's inspiring. And I think that we should continue to move towards that in the future. Thank you. That's kind of just my little input on that. Again, thank you for speaking. And I kind of got, I didn't plan on being here. I kind of came, you know, along with my grandmother and just happened to hear your speech. It was unexpected and it was truly a delight. Thank you again. That just was my input on that.
Shukran. Thank you very much. That means a great deal to me. When I make an effort to try to be a sympathetic outsider to another community, it means a lot to me to hear that affirmed by someone within the community. If I described an Islam tonight that you recognize, then I'm very grateful for that. So thank you. Thank you so much. One of the things I tell my students is that, and I say this because I experienced it myself. Whatever you think Islam is, if you think it's this, it's this. Well, I went in thinking it's this, and it's this. Whatever you think Islam is, it's something wider than that. That was certainly my experience, and I'm grateful to have been able to learn what I learned, and it was wonderful to be your guest tonight, as well as being a homeboy, but thank you so much for this opportunity to be together, and yes, thank you.